This session has the title Faith and Geology: Musings of a Process Geologian. I wanted to have a different title, and Catherine suggested maybe Mutterings of a Process Geologian. Which kind of, the title, there's a branch of theology known as process theology, and I don't know too much about process theology, but I think it has something to do with the emphasizing that our discovery of God or our knowledge about God is continually in development, continually in process. So process theology is something. It turns out that there is something called process geology. In the past, geologists used to emphasize naming things, naming rocks or naming landforms or naming types of structures, and now many textbooks are rewritten to place the emphasis on now not what a structure is, whether it's a butte or a mesa, but what kind of process went on to differentiate those. So that was a play on words there, the kind of clever thing that brought you all here today.
And now a word from our sponsor.
The Holden summer theme is the image of God. And I was reflecting on this week, though people haven't said those words that much, all the sessions seem to be about the image of God and re-imaging what the image of God might be in light of other information. We're challenged to re-envision the image of God. We, as Witt and Christy have said, we are unraveling and re-knitting the image of God. We are reimagining the image of God based on our life's experience, on our curiosity, on our imagination, on our interaction with each other. And I would say that our re-knitting of the image of God is influenced by our faithfulness, or our earnestness, or our honesty, prayerfulness, etc. I think Berger's Bible session, some of you have been to those, using historical criticism to re-look at what in this week Corinthian letters have been about, and what those what a re-imaging of God might be like with those. A challenging one with Bruce Wallenberg on re-imaging God as a central God for all the world's religions. Looking at Sherry's work, looking at relationships and relationship structures, and I think there are things in the Bible that inform us about relationships that are not the best. And then the work that Christy and Witt have done on violence, and re-looking at biblical images and trying to exorcise a little bit the violent images that are in there. I'm trying to tie all these together. Not sure if it's working. But what I want to do today is, from our knowledge about the earth and the way the earth works, or the universe, this is our knowledge about the earth also causes us to re-examine our notions from the Bible about what the image of God is. All of these are challenges kind of from outside the faith that we have to respond to in some way. Does that sound like that all this?
Yes.
So that's kind of the context I was thinking this about. Yesterday I gave a session on people as geology, meaning that we as human beings are unique creations on this, or creations of this planet. We are one phenomenon of this planet. We are one aspect of our planet. The planet has volcanoes, trees, subduction zones, crust, liquid core, people, bears, you know. We are kind of geology. We are what we are and who we are because the earth is what the earth is. And I wanted to make that as kind of, I wanted to base that on knowledge that we've gained from science, but I wanted to make it as poetic and beautiful as possible. And we are outgrowths of this yearning of matter to be alive. And here we are now to be alive and reflect on the beauty of the planet. We are geology. The earth is alive. This, I think, as I was writing these notes today, I think that for people that aren't geologists, this is maybe disturbing. Because usually when we put ourselves in the context of evolution and space and everything, we are merely a very insignificant creature in space and time. And I have to remind myself that some people are going to have that reaction. As a geologist, when I am doing investigations or when I find a rock and I go, oh, cool, look at that. Or when I'm doing my field work and I find some outcrop that kind of puts the whole picture together for my research study. You know, it's just, God, that's neat. Look at that. That's great. You know, you want to write people. And it's just neat. And you get this, and there's also the research I do, I think, is rather mundane if I were to describe it. But I find out things, and every geologist does this, finds out things about the Earth, the way the Earth worked, the way the Earth works, that nobody has known before. And I don't mean to make that sound like this is a power trip, you know, like I really know a lot. But it's kind of like the Earth has been silenced. These are scriptures, in a way, that have come to life. And it always strikes me as being amazing. So when I like to associate, when I call myself a geologic phenomenon, then I like that identification that, you know, these rocks are cool, and I'm cool. we're cool. I mean, people are neat, et cetera, et cetera. Any questions that people, a lot of you were here yesterday, is there any questions that you had from yesterday? Okay. What I want to talk about today, then, is faith in geology and some of the ways that these butt up against each other. And it's hard to put all these notions that I was thinking about in some kind of order. So I will go, I've got a few pages of this, and I will go a ways and we'll stop and talk about it. My talking will not last the whole time, so if you have something you want to say, please raise your hand. First of all, I like this vision, and some of these are more directly related to our faith and not, but I like this vision of us being more connected to the earth for three reasons to begin with. It makes me feel more earthy. If I'm part of the earth, it makes me feel more earthy. The material that we're made of comes from the universe, comes from the stars. We are natural. There's no way around it. There's no way that we can separate ourselves from nature. We are totally natural. We shouldn't be guilty about who we are. So it makes me feel more earthy. At the same time, it makes the earth seem more human. It's coming together, a narrowing of our differences, it seems. When I look at the earth, it's not something to have power over. It's not something that's separate from me. It's not something that I have to defend myself against. It's something that's now more recognizable. It's like me. It's like a relative. It's my brother, my sister, Mother Earth. There's something familiar about the earth. And because of those two things, it also, the third reason here, it also makes those things that I already do seem more natural. Beavers build dams, birds build nests, we build houses, we drive cars. We don't have to, and there's some problems with this, but you don't have to feel guilty for, I mean, Holden Village, these buildings are not an abomination to nature. This is another thing that nature does. Nature makes people, people make tools, people make houses. Buildings are natural. I was at, whenever I think about this, I remember a time when I was on the Hopi Mesas in northern Arizona. I had a friend in graduate school, and he said, let's go up to the Bean Dance at the Hopi Mesas. And this was a fantastic place to go. You're out in these old pueblos where there's this pinyon smoke and coal smoke in the air, and there's no electricity out here, and here are these, this is one of the, some of the mesas have electricity. But we were out there from about midnight to 3 in the morning going into kivas, watching these dances. And we left before they all finished. They would have gone on all night. But the next day, we went to another village where there's some dances. And I remember just being just kind of overwhelmed with how these people were connected and everything. And in a kind of a misty kind of feeling, walked over the edge of the mesa to gaze out to the desert, you know, and think about all this stuff. And I looked down at my feet, and here was the trash heap of the village. There was an old washing machine down there, a dead dog, an empty box of fab, and all this kind of stuff. And what it struck, I mean, there's a couple ways to look at it. What it struck me, archaeologists are always looking through, what do they call them, middens, places where people have thrown away things from the village to find out something about that village. We throw things away. It's kind of natural to throw things away. And these Indians were throwing things away. And there was something okay about that. Now, obviously, we're at a point now with our trash situation, our throwaway society, where this has gone to an extent there, where it needs to be corrected in some way. It's not sustainable, but it's natural to throw things away, too. So, this connectedness makes me feel more earthy, makes the earth seem more human, and makes what I do already seems somewhat natural. But we are disconnected from this. We are estranged from the earth, to use a theological word. We seem to be unaware of these connections that we have. And we're reaching a point now where there is ecologic problems on the earth. And I don't know the answer to this, but I have a question in my notes here, is why have we become disconnected? Why are we disassociated from this? If we get our meaning from the earth, from relating to nature, everybody yesterday talked about some great place they like to go and they feel really connected to nature. If this is the way we like to be, how come we're not that way? Any ideas about that?
Capitalism.
Capitalism. That came up this morning.
One word, that's all you need. You move from agrarian into industrial, you lose that connection with Mother Earth. If there's something beautiful, you'll get torn down and a high rise will be built on it.
Why would we choose to go to capitalism from agrarianism? I mean, we have moved.
We don't choose it. It happens to us if we live in that society.
That's right. That's right.
We call it progress, too. Quote, progress. I see it from a simplicity standpoint to a complexity standpoint to where we're at now. Mm-hmm. You know, and that complexity due to, you know, technology, comforts, you know, things that bring us comfort within a city that further separates us from the wilderness, as the pioneers were so scared to death of the wilderness.
Is that why we think only of the moment and not the long range, and therefore ignore the consequences of our actions?
I think this is one consequence, our disconnectedness. There was an Indian activist named Gerald Clifford. He's a Lakota Indian from South Dakota. He came to Chris Davis and talked. And he said, there's nothing that we do when we make a decision without thinking how this will affect 7 generations. And my first response was, you know, well, that's a real kind of Indian thing to say. I mean, it's really cool. But when you think about it, because maybe some of you had that same response, when you think about it, I want to get married, I want to have children, I can maybe imagine grandchildren, but I don't think about my great-grandchildren or my great-great-grandchildren or beyond that. And when you think about who your grandparents are, you know them, your great-grandparents, fuzzy memories, great-great-grandparents, I don't know who they are. I mean, you might go to a book and know a little bit, but we're so kind of disconnected from those people. So we are a very short term.
Well, it seems like to me that we've gone from, you know, being connected to nature to wanting to control it so much. I think that's where or whenever, or from building a dam, you know, to get us just enough water into more and more to where you don't really even have a river anymore.
Yeah.
Or you rerouted it, something like that. It seems like that we, as we get more and more people, you know, we have to control nature. You know, so someday we'll control the wind and the sun and all those things.
Well, yeah, I think so.
There's so much mobility that we don't have that long-term sense of connectedness if we use a place up. Or the lumber company moves on, the rest of us stay behind. But there's not a sense of commitment, long-term commitment to place.
Gary Snyder talks about an evolution of people when they come and move into an area. There's a period of 100 to 200 years of exploitation where the environment is used because it might appear to be limitless. Certainly the United States was seen like that by the early settlers. And then when the limits are reached, then people have to learn to re-inhabit the land, and then they adopt a sustainable lifestyle that's sustainable for so long. The idea that I like to bring out in this kind of discussion, I think that the core reason is our fear of death. There was a book several years ago by Ernest Becker called The Denial of Death, explaining that most of our behavior and our reason for developing society the way it is, or our character and all this, is based on our fear of death. That we are so radically abhorred by the fact that we are not going to exist much longer that we do everything that we can to deny it. And certainly the nature of nature seems to be this organic cycle of life and death. And looking at nature, we see death. We see our bones decomposing. We see the earth, the soil, blood. We see things that remind us of our mortality. And so we deny that. We don't want to face that. To deny our death implies that we must deny nature as well. I'm not sure, maybe that resonates with some people. For whatever reason, let me just say a few more things here and then we have some more time to talk. For whatever reason, we do see ourselves as connected, disconnected. We can say that we are, but we still see ourselves as disconnected from nature. We always talk about man and nature, humans and nature, people and nature. We never think of ourselves as part of nature. I think part of the reason why this is only natural, tigers probably think of tigers in nature. I mean, they probably don't give a hoot about other animals or other plants. They don't worry about the ecosystem. I mean, they are part of the ecosystem. They don't worry about it. So when people try to put this guilt trip on you about, you know, that people screwed up, they only think of themselves, I think it's natural to only think of yourselves. And that's one of the challenges of our ability to reflect on things and our progression, our unique role as natural creatures here, is that we are aware of the interconnectedness. Now, maybe people will argue that the animals know this on some other kind of level. That's another. But we do disassociate ourselves from the rest of nature. And because we're afraid of it, and I think we disassociate ourselves from nature based on the fear of death, we have two options. We're different from nature, we're either better than nature or worse than nature. So I like to call this one option that people take is that we see ourselves as kings and queens of creation. If we're different from nature, we are above nature. I used to call this king of creation, but yeah, that's kind of too sexist. So I like to call it kings and queens of creation, that we have been charged by the Bible to subdue the earth, it seems. The earth is made completely for us, for our disposal. We have a universe that's 30 billion light years across, that's 15 million years old. But for some reason, the whole thing was made for this tiny speck of a planet, for these animals that lived here in the last 4 million years. I mean, God kind of wasted a lot of space, a lot of time, if we are the point. But apparently we are the point. And I saw Chuck Colson once on the 700 Club one night, just flipping through the channels, just stopped there for a moment. You know, I wasn't really watching it. Chuck Colson, you remember him? He was one of the Watergate people that was put in jail for doing something wrong. And he and Pat Robertson were chuckling about the fact that everybody's worried about us running out of oil. And he said, oh, we're not going to run out of oil. I mean, God is going to put more oil in the ground for us. This is the king and queens of creation. God, this is all for us. I think even when you say that we are stewards of the planet, that is a little patronizing and condescending. Well, we'll help you out here, God. We're going to take care of your planet. Don't you worry. Things are in good hands. I think that's a good model to go to, but I think even that has some problems with it. So, one aspect of our disconnection is kings of creation. The other equally as wrong, for the exact same reason equally as wrong position, is that we're God's boo-boos. That somehow God made a mistake and nature was perfect and, shoot, made people back to the drawing board. That ultimate good is to be found in something completely untouched by people, the wilderness. I'm not saying that there's not a lot of good in wilderness. Obviously, we need to go to the wilderness for certain things. We are here partly for that reason. But to go into the wilderness and see somebody else's boot track and be, kind of depressed or something. I mean, this is wrong. We are part of our creation. God does not make mistakes. God does not make junk. We're not junk. We're part of the creation. We're not God's boo-boos. Any comments at this point? Yeah.
Yeah, that scripture that says we're supposed to multiply and subdue and all that. Is there anything anywhere that says what we're supposed to do after we've done that, which is now?
All right. We're not foolish to multiply.
I think that's partly our, I would say as Christians, that's partly our charge to figure that out. You know, and I think that's the role of meetings like this, conversations, science. I read an article just this spring in the Hungry Mind Review, which is published in Minneapolis. A writer named Bill McKibben, that's written on nature, talked about the relationship of the church to the environmental movement, and that he said when you look back in history, all the successful social change movements have had the church at the forefront, whether it be abolition of slavery, civil rights, even things like prohibition, had the church playing a leading role. And he was arguing that it's not until the church takes a leading role in the environmental crisis that we're going to have success in saving the planet, in ending some of our environmental problems. So I think it's one of the great tasks of our generation to try to reimagine the earth as image of God, as one manifestation of God's creation. I think things that we can take from the Bible for that is that though the word-by-word account given in Genesis, I would say, is inaccurate, there are things in there that I think can be kept and should be kept. Mainly that the earth is good. God created and said it's good. At every step of the way, including when God created humans, they were good. And the fact that God made it, I think we can, through faith, say that. God made all of the earth. It is a whole place. And that we are a part. Now, as a geologist, though, there are still some parts of the geologic story that give me some problems. Maybe some of you still have problems with evolution, things like that. So it'll take some time, I think, in our own minds to re-envision these things so they are comfortable and awe-inspiring as I think they can be. We've learned this week, at least I've learned this week, that the whole history of our Christian tradition has been one of transformation, of finding more and more out about God. The God of the Old Testament is different than the God of the New Testament. Christianity is a makeup of a mix of different religions. Maybe we're still on that process. We're still finding out more about God. And this is our chance where we're getting new sources to find out about God. And this is our chance to become closer to God. But there are some ideas here. Troubling notions from geology, perhaps. One is that the Earth is kind of whole at any given time. That there are ecosystems around the planet, and if they're not profoundly perturbed by human interaction or cosmic interaction or something, there is this wonderful web of interrelationship. And this wonderful web of interrelationships has existed all throughout geologic time. So if we believe that God sees the sparrow when the sparrow falls, then God saw the brontosaurus when the brontosaurus fell, or saw when the trilobite died. That every slice of history, 600 million years ago during the Cambrian, that was creation, and it was good. And it was complete in a sense. I think this kind of falls out of these ideas. So that even, it wasn't like the trilobites were swimming around going, well, it's pretty neat, but gee whiz, we wish we could be extant during the Pleistocene so we could see these humans for whom this earth was made. No, I think the earth was whole at all these different times. Buckminster Fuller, who was the person to read when I was in college, in one of his books called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth, has a couple versions of the Lord's Prayer at the end that he rewrites, and they're fanciful. But in one of them, his name for God is the Evolutionary Integrity Unfolder. There's a t-shirt. Evolutionary Integrity Unfolder. That at any given time, the world is whole. It's integrated. It's complete. But that it's continually changing through time. It's evolving. And God is the unfolding of that, or the power behind the unfolding. I like that idea. Another idea that's comes from geology that's a little bit disturbing. Our Christian faith seems to say a lot about death. And really, death is an evolutionary feature of ecosystems. There used to be a time when animals really didn't die, that there was the earliest forms of life reproduced asexually by splitting. So there were really those organisms, there might be some of those organisms still around, organisms 3 billion years old. It was only, I don't know when, a couple billion years ago that death was invented. Death was seen as a part of the whole, the good whole of this planet, as a necessary part of this whole. So as individuals, we die. Our religion seems to have death as a very important part of it. When we look at nature, when we look at evolution, it seems like this was part of the intended wholeness of creation to have.
I told him before I came in, I was going to have
a meeting. Oh, we needed a light moment at that point. Didn't we? Evolution of death. In fact, not only do individuals die, but species die naturally. that if you look at the evolutions of species, has how long an individual species lives in geologic time, they have a life expectancy of around 10 million years. Species come and go quite naturally. They are not weeded out because they are ineffectual. The ecosystem changes, and new species come forth, and new species, old species are left behind. There will, the consequence of that, or the conclusion, is that there will be some day when our species becomes extinct. The Earth is supposed to last for several billion more years. We've been around for 4 million, so maybe we've got 6 million years to go. And there'll be other life forms that come on this planet. So we're not the crown of creation. We're somewhere in the middle of the soup. Another idea. The people that look at evolution, the nature of evolution, especially Stephen Jay Gould, stress that evolution is not progressive. Though we look at single cell organisms in the Precambrian and we see these fine specimens, evolution doesn't seem to be progressive. That doesn't mean that there were more advanced creatures in the past, but that selection takes place in a random, chancy kind of way. During the Cambrian, which was around 600 million years ago, there were, in fact, more different types of animals around, more different forms, basic forms of animals. We have animals that fly, animals that are long, like worms and snakes. We have animals that swim. There were other animals, different body forms, during the Cambrian. Diversity was greater during the Cambrian than it is now. So you can't argue that evolution is progressive because diversity is actually decreased rather than increase. It's kind of like a symphony that's always kind of changing, but never really has an end.
Well, I guess my idea, what I always heard or thought, was that any organisms that became extinct was because they couldn't adjust. Therefore, they were lower. I was getting the impression that they were lower level of animal. I never tied that to the amount of species, as long as it was progressive or not progressive.
Certainly, species die out when they no longer can reproduce, when they fail in that environment. They fail to adapt. It's almost like the symphony moves on faster than the notes can. So at some point, evolution leaves them behind, and there's a planet.
But I always thought those were lesser developed organisms than what we have today. That's always the impression.
Yeah, that is the impression that you get, but that's not necessarily true. I would say that the woolly mammoths that died out 10,000 years ago were every bit as complicated as present-day elephants. And animals that die out in the past have been, Bruce Wallenberg always talks about, you hear this, Bruce? You've heard it here first. Always talks about dinosaur thinking. And dinosaurs were actually quite successful. They were around 25 times as long as we've been around so far. They were around 100 million years. We think of them as lumbering dumb giants. And they were quite successful as a species. Which brings me into another thing, another story from geology that kind of wreaks havoc with a sense of our own importance. The dinosaurs, people now believe, were killed off by meteors that hit the Earth around 65 million years ago. A wild hypothesis. Geology hates these kind of hypotheses. So you have all these geologists running around trying to disprove this idea that dinosaurs were wiped out by meteors, and everybody kind of goes, well, I think they might be right. I mean, there's lots of evidence for concluding that. Other geologists thought, well, if meteors did it once, maybe they did it other times. So they look back in the geologic record at those times that we call mass extinctions, when lots of animals were going extinct at the same time. And they looked at the chemistry of the layers around there, and there's other things you can look at. And they could find out that, yeah, it looks like this has happened in the past. The disturbing thing is that not only does it has it happened once or twice, it's happened several times in the past, and quite regularly. It happens once about every 30 million years.
So is it our time yet?
Yeah, I need to have a watch. Every class, I say that line, and then I can make a neat graph with this and see how many seconds it takes for somebody to ask that question. Fortunately, God let us evolve at a time in between meteor bombardments. No, we're about 15 million years, 60 million years after the last one, supposedly. Look at that. Well, what kind of universe is it that allows this wonderful life, these beautiful ecosystems, and all these connected creatures inspired by their creator and everything? What kind of creator is this? What kind of creation is this? Is every 30,000 years, I mean, this is Noah's Ark to the big extreme here. And it's not people that are going to survive. It's going to be like crickets or something. What does this say? Cockroaches anyway. What does this say about? I mean, it seems like a clumsy universe. Like, ooh, didn't know you had life there. Sorry. That just runs into our planet, destroys life, and then it comes on again, evolve again. I mean, that's a disturbing notion.
You seem to minimize the importance of the human race.
So I don't. Well, it's hard to say those things without having it sound like minimizing. These notions are depressing in some ways, in that they do minimize me. But another way to look at that is that's kind of a sin of pride in a way. That we were overestimating our importance. As a geologist, as somebody that's struck by wonder in creation, and that's a human response. This is a wonderful thing. I find there's a sense of gratitude as being a part of that. That we are as spectacular as supernova.
I'm wondering if we thought of ourselves genuinely as more important, that we might do something that we're not doing to prevent the catastrophe that seems to be right at our doorstep.
Well, okay, then there is a couple things I could say to that. I could refer back to Brian Swimmy that I read yesterday, where he sees humans as being the universe's desire to have a reflective consciousness, that we are here to see beauty. We are here to say, we, meaning the universe, is neat. We like us. This is a good universe. So we have a distinct role in that way. Another thing that comes to mind is that Stephen Jay Gould likes to talk about evolution being quite chancy, which it is. Quite creative, quite chancy. He would go so far as to say that our consciousness is kind of an accident of evolution. Our ability to reflect, that's a depressing notion too. Our ability to reflect is as we have adapted, one of the things that's the reason why we have music and culture and all these kind of things is that our brain has become more complex. It's kind of like computers being built more and more complicated to do certain things, and then they can discover, once they've made this kind of computer, that there were all these other things that they could do that they hadn't even planned on as a consequence of its size and complexity. And so our brains are like that, our nervous system is like that. We're so big, designed to do a certain kind of task, but we have all this other creative space. And he would say that's kind of accidental. But that it would be, who knows if it would ever happen again. There might be life on other planets, but maybe there's not consciousness on other planets. So then we are very special. And then we have a great obligation to ourselves, certainly, but creation.
And thinking of the image of God, have we not this transcendent quality that we are the only creature that can think about himself, thinking about himself, thinking about himself?
Yeah, I would say we definitely have an obligation. That's the end of my notes. What other kind of feelings does this arouse in you? It's meant to be a little bit disturbing, because I like to use geology to shore up my faith, because there's some just some absolutely beautiful things, but there's other things that kind of come along that are disturbing.
Well, it seems to me that culturally we have thought of ourselves as being up above the rest of creation, and the prevailing culture at least still does, but rather than feeling more sense of responsibility, we feel, well, we don't need to worry about that. We're so smart, we'll think our ways out of whatever problems we stumble into. And I think that seeing ourselves as a part of everything is probably a better way to go.
Well, that's impossible arrogance.
Also, going back to the symphony idea, if you look at creation as a symphony, then you can look at the changes as being the different movements, mm-hmm. that none of them are better or worse than the other. They're just new and different.
And I love the music analogies. I really like, but the element of chance can be handled with some beauty, I think. I like jazz music, and I like to play jazz music, and there are times when you play jazz, you come in with a group of people, and you, everybody, you might have a certain kind of structure, certain ground rules. This might be natural selection or something like that, or it might be music. It's going to be, let's do all the things you are. We'll do it in E flat, and it's got these chord structures. But once you have that, those kind of ground rules, which in nature might be chemistry, physics, whatever, there's no way to predict what's going to happen in that music. The responsibility of the musicians are to interact with each other, be true to themselves, but also to be true to each other. Musicians' responsibility is to be as much themselves, his or herself, as possible, and also to listen and be influenced by others as much as possible. So we're talking about a community here. And with those constraints, those freedoms, you let the music go, and you have no idea what's going to happen. But what happens, the more you are faithful to those things, beautiful music happens. As the more that you're completely honest to yourself, completely honest and listening to each other, you have. And it's chance in that sense, because you can't predict it. You're not planning it. It just happens. Something you play causes this person to play this. You hear that, causes you to play this. It's unpredictable. And that's part of the energy of improvised music or jazz music.
So creation is like a great jam session.
You bet. You bet. And that's the tragedy, maybe the greatest tragedy of our environmental crisis is that we have these incredibly beautiful symphonies, these ecosystems. The rainforest is this enormous, wet, green, alive, multidimensional symphony happening that's been going on for 70 million years, at least in the Amazon. We've been here the last 4 million years. So, I mean, the rainforest started long before we did. Incredible diversity. If you go into the rainforest, if you go into the forest around here and put your hand on a tree, and then put your hand on another tree, and then you put your hand on another tree, chances are after you hit two or three trees, you're going to start hitting the same kind of tree. Oh, there's that pine again. Oh, there's that poplar again. If you are in the Brazilian rainforest, you have to hit about 200 trees before you start finding the same species. Incredible diversity, incredible richness. It's like playing every symphony in the world at the same time, and it's harmonious. And we are destroying it so that, well, Japan serves fast food in wood boxes. Like we have Styrofoam McDonald's, they have these kind of shaped wood boxes they serve fast food in, fast food restaurants. Or when they build their skyscrapers, they have, they use a wooden, what am I trying to say? Scaffolding that they use once and throw away. I mean, why not? You know, you got the 70-million-year-old song. What other use could you use for it, you know?
Picnic table,
that'd be good. Picnic table, that'd be good. A good fire, big bonfire, that'd be good. To me, the image I like, and I guess, no, no, I've heard this, it's like smoking Rembrandts. Somebody discovered that you take a Rembrandt canvas and you roll it up and smoke it, and you get this great buzz.
Oh.
This is wonderful. And,
colored smoke, no doubt.
Colored smoke, oh yes, it's beautiful, it's wonderful. And then yeah, well, we're out of Rembrandts. Let's go to Van Gogh's or something. And, but then you're out of this great stuff. And that's sin. I would have to say, as a Christian, that the practice of going to church, to praying to Jesus, to taking sacrament, to being in community with other believers is still essential for me and very meaningful. And in no way does this kind of thinking hurt that for me. Worship is a source for me to kind of bravely continue on, to just to continue to think about these things. So it was helpful the other day when Bruce was talking about what he was talking about to say that he, you know, he was an active Christian, you know, disturbing us all with all this stuff. That is possible. That Berger said something wonderful this week. He said earlier this week, he said, faith is a risk. And that's part of it. I think all these new sources of information about the image of God, I think God is kind of calling us on. It's part of the risk of believing in God. The picture that I have about biblical inerrancy is I've pictured this every day this week of somebody, there's a windstorm, and here's this pole, and somebody's holding on to this pole, and the windstorm is blowing. It's got this person flung out sideways, and that pole is holding on to these old traditions that just don't work. And we have to, I think, have to let go and trust that we will be able to sail from this windstorm.
I just have a question about geology, basically. Is there a way that humans could make the planet unlivable ever again?
Well, this is another thing.
Stop life with that. It just seems so fantastic that something else is going to make it
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was something I wanted to say. I think it's, again, part of our pride when people say, save the planet, you know. The planet has no problems, really. We might take ourselves out, or we might ruin ecosystems for a while, but matter desires life. Every time the meteors came down and wiped out much of the planet, life came back. The Earth wants to be alive. And we are a magnificent creation. So it's even not that great of a tragedy if we kill ourselves off or maybe take out some of the ecosystems, because the Earth will bounce back. We won't be there to share it. We won't be part of it.
That's something that I've thought about before, that perhaps the extinction of the human species is, you know, certainly a shame. I'd hate to have it happen in my lifetime.
or the next seven generations.
But the idea that we could destroy what has never been destroyed, you know, in the history of this thing, if we could. It just somehow it seems like there are these little cells maybe waiting way down inside the planet that will come up again.
Yeah, that's true. And another way, another thing to think about there is there was a person that tried to figure out how much life is possible in the universe. I was telling Jane and Carol this the other day, somebody, that they, if you look at all the billions of galaxies in the universe, and to assume, calculate, we know how big the stars are, we know how big the sun is, and we can assume that this many stars are going to be the size of the sun, that might have this many planets, that might have this composition, et cetera, et cetera. If we put all those what ifs together, and they're all reasonable assumptions, and figure out how many planets in the universe could have life on it. And then you tell yourself, what if I'm off 1,000 times? What if I'm overestimating 1,000 times? I told them the other day, it was like, you know, if you said, I have $10 in my wallet, and then you open it up and you find, oh, I have 10,000. I mean, you don't rarely overestimate 1,000 times, but just to be very, 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 very conservative, let's say we've overestimated 1,000 times. There are still 10 million planets in the known universe that would have life on them. Which means the chances that there's one other planet out there in the universe, I mean, it just seems to be a given that there is life elsewhere in the universe. So even if we ruin life on this planet, matter wants to be life, it's happening somewhere else.
My feeling on this is if we're personally destroying the Earth, why on Earth are we out looking for something else in our universe to destroy?
We don't have that much power. We just don't have that much power.
Yeah.
We're not going to get there. It's several lifetimes probably to get the. We have to have some kind of teleporting device to get to another planet. That's a sad thing, I think.
I've talked to Al Pitcher about it a few times, you know, when I've been up here, and of course he's gone now, but he left, I guess, a few years ago. And he was saying that a model community, like Holden Village, only in a big way, is something that I think the whole world needs to really look at. There's 3 or 4 model communities and in different continents throughout the world. Something good for all of us.
The Bible says the meek shall inherit the earth, so if we want to inherit the earth, we should start learning to be meek.
You've been helpful to me in what you've said, and yet I want to quarrel with one thing, I think, and that is that it seems to me that we need a reverence for life. Mm-hmm. And we need even the belief in the infinite worth of the human personality. And if we believe that, if we really believe that, we wouldn't do what we're doing, either in war or neglecting the hungry and let them die.
I think it's we have to do that too. I agree with you too. And that's part of being natural, I think, to believe in our infinite worth. And I would say that we do have infinite worth in it, in a sense. Okay, well, we'll call it another comment. Yeah.
Well, you know, the world is waiting and watching our country. We're the ones that's leading the parade. They're all sitting back. I've been in many countries of the world, and they've still got the original trees, or what do you want to say, they've got all this of that, and their society in Spain or whatever it is, they're able to still reproduce, keep going, keep a capitalist system going, and still appreciate life and natural resources. We are the country that can't handle it. Now, Protestants don't want to listen to Pope John Paul, but he's out there saying, hey, you can have a capitalism, but it has to have a capitalism with a heart, a feeling of humanism and resources and Mother Nature and the world. You know, we've got to live as a world worrying, thinking about everyone. Now, in our society, we elect a guy who runs on a program of a kinder and gentler nations, country, and that's what we want. You know, that's what we idealize. So we go pull a handle, we vote for him. But when he gets in there, he does exactly the opposite. He's out to make a profit. The bottom line is to pay the stockholders, and that's what it is. And we're sitting back theorizing and all this, and now we can do all this, but really, as Americans, we have to change. We have to get a leader who's going to mean what he says and mean it. You've got to have a man, I don't know, shouldn't say this, no Lutherans here, but we need a John F. Kennedy. We do. We need a good man like Jimmy Carter. We need a good man like Walter Mondale. These men believe in capitalism, but they believe that it can work and not run full bore. We have capitalism without a heart in America. I hate to tell you that. We'll exploit Guatemala, El Salvador, or anything for resources. We don't care. And it can't be that way and keep going. But we are America, and it's our mentality, and I don't know how we're going to do it, but pay the stockholders. That's what we're after.
And in fact, the Bill, you should repeat what you said today about the meeting between the environmentalists and the power company.
Oh yes, I was at a meeting on energy planning that the power producing executives and environmentalists set up for that purpose, and they said, "Keep the pressure on. Keep our feet to the fire. That's the only way we can do what we know we need to do, and not have the stockholders."
Is that they're required by law to make maximize the profit for their stockholders?
Right. That's the bottom line.
And the stockholders can sue them if they don't do that.
Right.
So you can't. It's kind of an amoral system. You can't blame, in a sense, the power companies because they're just keeping the customers satisfied, and customers are investing to make money.